Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with American historian James Loewen, whose famous quote, "People have the right to their own opinions, but not their own facts," was expropriated by George Zimmerman on his new website, along with quotes from Thomas Paine and Edmund Burke. Since James Loewen has taught race relations for 20 years and has written about sundown towns that kept blacks out, he is none too happy to be featured on Zimmerman's website. He has an article at the History News Network, George Zimmerman, Trayvon Martin, and me. Then, since tomorrow will be the second anniversary of the BP blowout in the Gulf, we will speak with Aaron Viles, who leads the Gulf Restoration Network's response to the BP drilling disaster and the organization's efforts to protect and restore coastal habitats throughout the Gulf. We will discuss the contrast between BP's slick propaganda campaign on TV and the reality on the shores and in the waters of the Gulf and the failure of the Justice Department to prosecute anyone. Then finally, as Earth Day approaches, we will get an assessment of where we stand in the face of the global warming crisis. And since our government is paralyzed by powerful interests who continue to propagate denial, we will look into what citizens can do to save the planet. Gar Lippo, the author of a new book, Solving the Climate Crisis, Public Investment in Social Prosperity to Cool a Fevered Planet, joins us. And joining us now is James Loewen, a sociologist and historian who spent 2 years at the Smithsonian surveying 12 leading high school textbooks of American history, only to find an embarrassing blend of bland optimism, blind nationalism, and plain misinformation. He is a best-selling author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your High School History Textbook Got Wrong, Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism, and The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader. He previously taught race relations for 20 years at the University of Vermont and has a piece at the History News Network, George Zimmerman, Trayvon Martin, and me. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Loewen.
Hey, I'm glad to be with you.
So tell me how you felt when you were expropriated by George Zimmerman on his new website, along with quotes from Thomas Paine.
It was quite a website. It's kind of like the website I would make if I did my own website. It wasn't very well done. But I was in good company, wasn't I? I mean, the three guys that I was linked with, all of whom are dead, were Thomas Paine, who's kind of a hero of mine in all matters except personal hygiene, and who said a good quote that he used. Edmund Burke, with his famous quote, "The only thing we need for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing." And Henrik Ibsen, the famous playwright. And me. So that was good. And the next thing I felt was, well, he took two whole sentences from Lies My Teacher Told Me, my bestseller, and they stand alone. That is, he didn't rip them out of context. He didn't distort them. So I wasn't upset on that score. I think they say something, I'm doing this from memory, but something like, everybody has a right to their own opinion, but you don't have a right to your own facts. You have to use real facts, not facts that you made up. This quote, incidentally, isn't totally original. It was said by Bernard Baruch more than half a century ago, and then it was said by Daniel Moynihan, and it was probably said by some folks 200 years ago. I don't know. But anyway, on the other hand, there is the other hand. It did kind of worry me that I'd be linked with George Zimmerman. And what's interesting is, here the quote that he uses is on, I think, page 358 of my book, almost at the end. My book, Lies My Teacher Told Me. Could he have read that far? If he had read that far, well, the book is, among other things, an anti-racist work. Unless you're arguing with it, and of course some people do read a book just to rebut it, but unless you're arguing with it, it ought to teach you some things that you didn't know, hopefully, and that show that, gosh, you know, the United States has been dramatically racist towards Native Americans, especially at first, and then also as well, of course, towards African Americans, and that these things still influence our thinking and to some extent even our actions in the present. And that's the kind of stuff I'd like George Zimmerman to have experienced. But I have the feeling that he didn't read a whole bunch of Ibsen plays, and he didn't read a whole bunch of Edmund Burke, and he didn't read a whole bunch of my work. I have the feeling somebody kind of gave him these quotes.
Well, and not to mention Thomas Paine, who, of course,
yes,
the Tea Party have expropriated, even though he was violently anti-religious. And
the Tea Party has taken him?
Oh, yes, they took him a long time ago.
Oh, for heaven's heaven's sake. Well, yes, as you point out, I mean, he's not exactly their, shall we say, cup of tea.
No, and he certainly, in terms of the religious right, you couldn't have chosen a worse standard bearer, in as much as he once said, belief in a cruel God makes a cruel man. So tell me about, I mean, the other thing, James Loewen, that I find extraordinary, again, James Loewen, sociologist and historian, author of Lies My Teachers Told Me, Everything Your High School History Textbook Got Wrong, and Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism, that has particular echoes in Florida, doesn't it? And there were race riots in the 20s. I think it was at Rosewood or somewhere.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, in Rosewood, in... what is it? It starts with an O, not Ocono, Oconee, I think it is.
It's very close to the Zimmerman country there.
Yeah. Well, yes. On the other hand, you can find sundown towns almost everywhere in the north. I need to say that a sundown town, of course, is a town that's all white on purpose, or for many, many years was. Many of them have reformed and are no longer all white, but many have not. And Florida is just about the only place in the South that has a whole lot of them. All the way around the outside of Florida, many, many towns, including large cities like Miami Beach, flatly kept out, in the case of Miami Beach, Jews and probably black folks. Cape Coral, probably. Gulfport, for sure. And then a few towns in the inside of Florida also did this. Ocoee, I think that's the name of it. For some reason, I'm looking at my map, and I can't see it right now. However, Sanford wasn't a sundown town, so far as I know. So I don't want to tar Zimmerman, you know, with that brush particularly. I think it's interesting, though, that all kinds of Americans, including many of our major political leaders, grew up in or chose to live in or even still live in sundown towns. And people don't call them on it and need to know about it.
Give us some names, if you will, James Loewen.
Well, both our last president, George W. Bush, and our last vice president, Darth Vader. No, that wasn't his name. He wasn't my very favorite.
Richard Cheney, M. Cheney,
course,
yes. Yeah.
Chose to live in Highland Park, Texas. Now, Highland Park, in a way, you could call it a suburb of Dallas. I use the term inburb because it's entirely surrounded by Dallas, it and its sister inburb, University Park. And both of them were set up to be free of blacks. And, in fact, the only African-Americans allowed to live in Highland Park were live-in servants. And that was true really only until about four years ago, when the first black family ever bought a house in Highland Park. There was a big controversy, incidentally, after the Brown versus Board of Education decision, especially when it started being enforced, because the live-in servants in Highland Park, some of them had children, and those children were, of course, not allowed to go to school at all in Highland Park, and so they had an arrangement that they would go to the closest school in Dallas, and I think maybe Highland Park had to pay some kind of tuition fee for them in Dallas. And then Brown v. Board came down, Dallas stopped that. And as a result, there was a move to throw all of these families out of Highland Park, even as live-in servants. And I actually think they did it, although I'm not at all sure if they did or not. But I know there were politicians who argued this is what we have to do because we certainly can't have them in our public schools.
Well, but sundown towns also has a sinister connotation, surely, that after sundown...
You're not allowed.
You're not allowed, yeah. And maybe your life's in danger.
And that's pretty much true. I have talked with people who themselves saw African-American maids running to catch the last bus out of a Los Angeles suburb, for instance, lest they be stranded in town after dark. I talked with the daughter of a man who was a taxi driver in a Indiana town, who, out of the goodness of his heart, actually, would give black folks a ride to the edge of town so that they wouldn't be in trouble because they were there as dark approached. So it was. But of course, the main point, even if you could be there until say 8 p.m., you couldn't live there. And these are terrible towns, terrible inventions, because they make it all too easy to think to conclude, well, it's right to live like this. Very few people say, well, it's wrong, and my parents did a terrible thing by raising me there, or especially if they're not the kid, if they're the person. I mean, President Bush, before he was president, living in University Park, in Highland Park, can hardly say to himself, it's wrong for me to live in a town that's all white on purpose. So what's the alternative? I think the alternative says it's all right to do that, and what's the rationale for it being all right? Well, because we should be keeping them, and of course I'm using them with italics, out. So I think it's possible to grow up non-racist or not racist in a sundown town, but I don't think it's very easy.
Again, I'm speaking with James Lowen, sociologist and historian. He previously taught race relations for 20 years at the University of Vermont and has a piece at the History News Network, George Zimmerman, Trayvon Martin, and Me. Do you think anything good can come of this Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman thing? Of course, the trial hasn't begun, and we don't know whether or not he'll be convicted of second-degree murder or something less. But we do have memories, of course, of the O.J. Simpson trial that was very polarizing. Not that there's any comparison there.
Well, I think a better example would be the Rodney King trial. Because, of course, in the case of Rodney King, the police were actually doing the beating, and there was no death. But like this Trayvon Martin case, it became a flashpoint, a point of consciousness for black folks all across the country. And I think that's too bad. I wish that hadn't happened. And while I don't want I am white myself. While I don't want African Americans to be uninformed, I don't want them to be stupid, not at all. But at the same time, I think we can make too much of the details of a case like this in Florida, which we don't know that much about. Now, the good thing about it being such a flashpoint is it looks like a correction has taken place, we hope. At the very least, we have a new prosecutor, and we seem to have a prosecution, whereas before it got all this media attention, we didn't have any prosecution. It looked like it was all going to be just okay. So I have to contradict myself and say, well, I guess the media attention was a good thing. At this point, I hope that we have a completely open trial with good evidence coming out. And I think that to the degree that we have that, that'll be what we need. If that evidence shows that, yeah, George Zimmerman was right to feel attacked, and any normal person in that situation would have felt attacked, hopefully that'll be bought by everybody, at least by most of everybody. If, on the other hand, the evidence shows, this is an outrage, it clearly shows racial profiling, and this kid was clearly trying to get away, then I hope that everyone on every side will be convinced again, and Zimmerman will be put away.
Well, I think what we do know, and I agree with you, a lot of people have jumped the gun and assumed things without the facts, and the trial will be very useful in as much as facts will be presented and explored. What we do know is that the police department down there in Sanford was obviously incredibly racist because they took the body of Trayvon Martin, did not inform the parents, even though they had his cell phone, and they did drug tests on Trayvon Martin's body and didn't drug test George Zimmerman, which is fairly routine.
I think that, let's see, you use the term incredibly racist. Well, I guess so. It's certainly an outrage, and they should have both been tested.
What about a parent not knowing what happened to their kid for 3 days?
And that's an I didn't even notice that. Is that what happened?
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Yeah. All right. Now I'm getting upset.
Well, I don't want you to get too upset because I still want to talk to you about the broader issues which you've, of course, have explored over the years, James Lowen, again, a sociologist and historian, previously taught race relations for 20 years at the University of Vermont and has a piece at the History News Network, George Zimmerman, Trayvon Martin, and Me. And his quotes appeared in the new website of George Zimmerman, quoting James Lowen's statement from an early book, Lies My Teacher Told Me Everything Your High School History Textbook Got Wrong, the quote being, people have a right to their own opinions, but not their own facts. Evidence must be located, not created, and opinions not backed by evidence cannot be given much weight. it does seem that the truth has become a moving target in the United States today. There's little consensus on what the truth is. People do their own reality shopping. Christians go to Christian networks, liberals go to MSNBC, conservatives to Fox for their information and their reality. In politics, he who spins the truth most cleverly wins the argument. Is there any way, do you think, that and a lot of people, particularly I think on the conservative side, don't even believe in data. They deny global warming and evolution. So how do you think we restore some kind of consensus in this country about basic facts, empirical thinking, data?
Sure. Well, I think that's a very good question, and I think you phrased it well. That is to say, all of the examples that you gave are examples of they're really happening, and they're really serious. I think it's not hopeless. Let me speak from my own experience. Last January, by which I mean 14, 15 months ago in January, I wrote an op-ed piece for the Washington Post. And amazingly enough, it actually got printed. I even got paid for it. It's in their series called Five Myths. And my title was Five Myths About Why the South Seceded. Now, this is something near and dear to my heart, because here we are 150 years after secession. The state of South Carolina seceded first, of course, and it left the Union just before Christmas, 150 years ago. And on Christmas Eve, that is December 24th of last year, was the 150th anniversary of their statement as to why they left the Union. Well, they are quite clear. They say that they are against states' rights and in favor of slavery. And they list the states and they list the rights that really upset them. Pennsylvania, for instance, trying in little bitty ways to kind of interfere with the action of the Fugitive Slave Act, which was a titanic national act, the strongest national act up until that time. New York no longer allowing what's called temporary slavery or slavery transit, so that you couldn't bring your cook into New York for a couple of weeks while you watched Broadway plays or something. She became free. Well, South Carolina rants about these things and gives them as reasons why she is leaving the United States. What it's all about is slavery. And to some extent, the election of Lincoln, and the reason they're upset by the election of Lincoln, and they say this openly, is because he's against slavery. Well, I have asked thousands and thousands of people across the United States, why did the South secede? And what I get overwhelmingly is they seceded for states' rights, even though I just told you, quoting the documents, that they seceded against states' rights. So teachers and others, just general Americans, are 180 degrees wrong about this, and yet we've been going on for 150 years since it happened. So that's just an example of the problem. Well, I wrote this in my Washington Post article, and I got 1,200 emails as a result. It turns out it was the most read piece at the Washington Post for all of last year. A lot of these people were arguing with me. They were what we would call neo-Confederates, the kind of people you were just mentioning who maybe they listened to the right-wing Rush Limbaugh and such, but probably not, because he might be too far left for them. Emails were vicious, some of them. You can always tell you got a problem if the title of the email says, "You are so full of," and I won't say this on the radio, but you know where I'm going. Mm-hmm. But I replied to all of them but two. Two were just too disgusting. And my reply, basically, to this kind of email went, "Well, your quarrel is really not with me." And sometimes I'd say, comma, full of blank or not, but your quarrel is with what the Confederate states said as they left the Union. Why don't you read my book, The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader, which is my newest book, and with a co-author, and it actually contains all this information that I just mentioned. Well, do you know, I got back, I don't know, maybe as many as 8, maybe even 10 replies saying, "Well, you got a point, and in fact, I'm going to do that." One person even said, "I just ordered the book from Amazon." So, you know, other people did write back and say, I don't care what you say, you're still so full of. But I did reach some of them. So I think it can be done, and we just have to keep doing it.
Well, James Lowen, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, it's been a pleasure being on.
Again, I've been speaking with James Lowen, who's a sociologist and historian who spent 2 years at the Smithsonian surveying 12 leading high school textbooks of American history, only to find an embarrassing blend of bland optimism, blind nationalism, and plain misinformation. He is the best-selling author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your High School History Textbook Got Wrong, Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism, and The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader. He previously taught race relations for 20 years at the University of Vermont and has a piece at the History News Network, George Zimmerman, Trayvon Martin, and me. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about tomorrow's second anniversary of the BP blowout in the Gulf just on the eve of Earth Day.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
Excuse me, mister, but isn't that your oil in the sea? And the pollution in the air, Mr. Hose, could that be? So excuse me, Mr. But I'm a mister too. And you're giving Mr. the bad name, Mr. Like You. Now I'm taking the Mr. from out in front of your name.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Aaron Viles, who leads the Gulf Restoration Network's response to the BP drilling disaster and the organization's efforts to protect and restore coastal habitats throughout the Gulf. He serves on the executive committee of the Delta chapter of the Sierra Club, the board of advisors to the Gulf Coast Fund for Community Renewal and Ecological Health, the Marine Fish Conservation Network, and previously served on Governor Bobby Jindal's environmental transition team. Welcome to Background Briefing.
Thanks so much for having me.
So tomorrow, Friday, will be the second anniversary of the BP disaster, the blowout. And it's extraordinary to think that 2 years later, the Congress has yet to pass one piece of legislation addressing the BP oil spill, and that the Justice Department has not filed any complaints. Nobody's gone to jail. Nobody's been arrested. Nobody's been indicted.
No, it's outrageous, really, the kind of lack of action on a number of fronts. And I think you've nailed one of them. The Department of Justice has not actually filed criminal proceedings yet. That's a real problem. And the Congress hasn't done anything to protect or restore this very much threatened ecosystem. So we're here in the Gulf. We're watching the oil. It's showing up every day. We've got a wide swath of the Gulf that's still just being pummeled by tar balls. And very good research just came out this week showing toxic components still in that oil 2 years later. And, it's something that the BP is spending lots of money putting out ads, getting everyone to think that it's all shiny and happy down here. But there's some trouble on the horizon, some trouble in the ecosystem, and some things that should make us all very nervous as we kind of watch this disaster unfold.
So all of that happy talk, and they usually use minority spokesperson BP to say that the business is back, tourism's back, fishing's back, you see people eating seafood, but you're saying that the dolphins are dying and there's problems with the oysters and other fisheries.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've talked to a lot of oystermen down in South Plaquemines Parish and, talking a lot about how their oyster spats aren't really setting, so the kind of baby oysters aren't showing up like they should be this time of year, which means they're going to be looking at problems 4 years down the line because it takes a while for an oyster to grow. So I think there's some real problems with the kind of long-term recovery of this ecosystem. There's some stuff that it's really troubling, this kind of sublethal impacts that we're seeing in the Gulf killifish, which is a really important bait fish. Good research that was done that showed very clearly the polycyclical aromatic hydrocarbons, these PAHs, the toxic constituents of BP's oil, very much affected the fish. So they've got gill damage, their hearts aren't developing properly, things that aren't necessarily killing the fish outright, but that makes them a lot more susceptible to other environmental stressors. Again, it's a sublethal impact, these things that can kind of snowball, cascade, and accumulate. You know, and that's when we look at things like the Exxon Valdez as a guide, sort of historical precedent. The herring fishery in Alaska didn't collapse 1 year or 2 years after their oil spill. It collapsed four seasons after that Exxon Valdez oil spill. So we're not even close to out of the woods at this point.
Well, but also after the Exxon Valdez oil spill, the Oil Pollution Act of 1990 was passed, and after the Santa Barbara oil spill of 1969, Earth Day was created, and in many ways that was the beginning of the modern environmental movement. Nothing much has happened since the BP disaster in terms of galvanizing the environmental movement.
No, I think that's true, and I think it's really unfortunate. I mean, maybe if this had happened in Santa Barbara or in more picturesque Prince William Sound, we'd see a more significant response. But here in the Gulf, you know, we've been here for 18 years looking to restore it. It's certainly something we've been fighting every day for our entire organizational history. But what we saw is that, you know, the nation has kind of disaster ADD now. And I think the 24-hour news cycle does not help us to kind of see things through to some sort of conclusion until we get some sort of, you know, response. There was also an election that I think really put us in a horrible situation. Because if you remember, you know, when the BP disaster happened, actually some of the environmental movement's best friends were heading up some of the House committees that deal with these types of issues. But then there was an election, things transitioned, and some of the environmental movement's worst enemies were then in charge of these committees. And the problem went from BP, their cleanup response, the oil and its impacts, to the Obama administration not letting drilling happening quick, getting drilling happening quick enough in the Gulf of Mexico. So that transition and that pivot was really problematic. You know, the media story, you know, the oil didn't disappear when the Chilean miners were trapped, but our national and international media attention certainly did. And if it's, you know, kind of, if you don't hear about the story, it must be okay. And so that was something that I think hurt our ability to really kind of take some of the recommendations that were being made by some really kind of blue ribbon commissions, some kind of very august bodies that had some really great thinkers about what we could do better. You know, those recommendations kind of landed with a thud, unfortunately.
Well, elections have consequences. And in 2010, the Republicans won back the House. And they, as you've mentioned, they totally changed the agenda. And recently, the president tried to end government subsidies for oil companies who were making record profits and was shut down very quickly by the Republicans. So, but then you have down in your state, Louisiana, you have very oil-friendly Democrats, right?
By and large, yeah. I mean, the entire delegation in Louisiana, Mississippi, Texas, these guys are all very much like the oil industry. And like I said, they were outraged by the response to the BP disaster, and they're mostly outraged because they had stopped oil drilling. So that was, I think, really troubling, and we didn't have the kind of leadership we really needed.
So is there any leadership that you see, or are you left with just grassroots activism?
Well, we certainly have that. We've got a very robust, you know, movement of, you know, kind of scrappy groups down here that are working really hard to make a difference. One thing that is happening as we speak is the House of Representatives did pass this thing called the Restore the Gulf Coast Act, which they did it in a way that is very kind of ugly sausage making. They attached it to a transportation bill. I think in the same time they're attaching the Keystone XL pipeline to this transportation bill, so kind of forcing the Sophie's choice on the environmental movement. But what we do know is the Restore Act is kind of one of these, you know, very much no-brainer legislation. It basically changes the law so that BP's Clean Water Act fines, which are, you know, billions of dollars. It's a remaining liability that hasn't been settled, but it's anywhere from 5 to as much as $20 billion that BP will have to pay for this historic oil spill. And it will change the law so that money doesn't go into the black hole of the federal treasury, but this amazing windfall historic oil spill fine will go to empower a historic environmental restoration project in the Gulf of Mexico. And it's something that totally makes sense. It's only fair, you know, that the ecosystem that BP's oil is now helping to threaten gets restored to a sustainable point by these fines. But so that happened. It was passed by the House. The Senate passed something similar. They're going to need to reconcile their two transportation bills. But, you know, what I think that does mean is, you know, depending on how this all plays out, we could see in the next few weeks finally a piece of legislation signed that does do something for the Gulf in the wake of the disaster. So there might be a ray of hope out there. But, again, we're going to need to see some leadership, because I know there's national concern, international concern about the Keystone Pipeline. So that's something that's going to be wrestled with. And like I said, it's sausage making. It's kind of ugliest right now, but we think at the end of the line, we could see these historic Clean Water Act fines, which, you know, the Department of Justice is going to have to get aggressive and actually get from BP. But that could go to restoration initiatives down here in the Gulf that are long needed.
Again, I'm speaking with Aaron Viles, who leads the Gulf Restoration Network's response to the BP drilling disaster and the organization's efforts to protect and restore coastal habitats throughout the Gulf. He serves on the executive committee of the Delta Chapter of the Sierra Club, the board of advisors for the Gulf Coast Fund for Community Renewal and Ecological Health, the Marine Fish Conservation Network, and previously worked on Governor Bobby Jindal's environmental transition team. How is Governor Jindal handling this? Has he gone over to the dark side, or?
Well, I think Governor Jindal probably started on the dark side, honestly. I think the man, he's part of this whole Louisiana political establishment that loves the oil industry and everything they want to do. So, you know, I think Bobby Jindal was relatively forceful in a few efforts that were really important. One thing that's very interesting about Louisiana, even though it is a relatively, you know, it's a very red state, and it very much, you know, doesn't have a lot of concern about environmental issues. One issue does, in fact, resonate, and that's Louisiana's coastal wetlands crisis. So we have seen, you know, Louisiana is losing wetlands at an unprecedented rate. Our coastal wetlands, because of how we've managed the Mississippi River for shipping and for flood control, how we've allowed the oil industry to historically dredge thousands of miles of canals through the marsh, we're losing a football field of wetlands turning to open water every hour. And that is something that makes our communities far more vulnerable. It means the fisheries, you know, are losing their most important nursery ground. And BP's oil was basically washing up in an ecosystem that was in a crisis state. So, you know, Governor Jindal has been very good about pressuring President Obama to commit to the long-term restoration of this ecosystem. And I think, you know, very much willingly, President Obama has been a partner on that. So I think there's some stuff that they've actually been very good at and worked together well at. The state of Louisiana, even though they're now letting teachers teach alternative theories to global warming in our schools, they put together a very good science report that looks at how you restore these coastal wetlands, and it, in fact, does take into consideration sea level rise. So we've got a plan to spend the BP funds, if they do, in fact, arrive down here, in a way that's science-driven, that will put our wetlands on a path to sustainability and will ensure that, you know, we're here for the long haul. So it's, I think it's an interesting mix, you know, because Bobby Jindal and President Obama very much have different constituencies, and they're both politicians. They both play to their constituencies, but there is some common ground here in that they both are very much committed to Louisiana's coastal wetlands and doing something that's, you know, to the scale necessary to put them on a path toward sustainability.
Again, I'm speaking with Aaron Viles, who leads the Gulf Restoration Network's response to the BP drilling disaster and the organization's efforts to protect and restore coastal habitats throughout the Gulf. And of course, tomorrow, Friday, April the 20th, is the two-year anniversary of BP's Deepwater Horizon rig explosion in the Gulf of Mexico, which killed 11 workers and poured 200 million gallons of oil into the Gulf waters. And of course, Sunday, April the 22nd, is Earth Day. When you talk about, though, restoring the ecosystem down there at the end of the Mississippi where it meets the Gulf, and you mentioned the erosion that's going on. Isn't so much of that, though, a result of the diversion of the Mississippi, the work of the Army Corps of Engineers? That had the Army Corps of Engineers, after all, they were in many ways responsible for the Katrina catastrophe. If they hadn't meddled so much with the Mississippi, nature would be taking care and building these barrier islands.
Well, theoretically. I think, you know, if you look back at what has been done in the Mississippi River Delta since 1927, the great flood there that, you know, after which the Corps of Engineers committed to not letting the Mississippi River flood again, And I think, yes, there likely would have been less of an impact from Hurricane Katrina, because we probably wouldn't have seen levee failures. We would have seen wetlands and ecosystems out there to buffer the storm surge that came in. But, you know, I think we got to play the hand we're dealt. And at this point, we've got the Mississippi River, which has been constrained and straitjacketed. So it's dumping sediment and fresh water just straight out into the deep water of the Gulf of Mexico. What we also have, though, is another example, which is the Atchafalaya River, which splits off, you know, north of Baton Rouge and carries about a third of the Mississippi River's flow. That is a much different story, because we did not straitjacket the Atchafalaya. We let it, you know, kind of continue as a wild river basin. And it's building land right now. It's building marsh. It's building with sediment loads. It's creating land in the face of sea level rise. So we know that if we kind of get out of nature's way and put the river back into some of these marsh ecosystems, we can put it on the path towards sustainability. But yes, there's a certain irony in that we will likely use the Corps of Engineers as one of the tools in the toolbox to do these restoration projects. They've got to be at the table, because they manage that river. Some say mismanaged, but it's certainly something where the science is in. We know we can build land with these diversions. We just need to kind of let the river do its business into these areas that certainly, without it, will be washing away, will be turning to open water each and every hour. Again, another football field disappearing. So it's something we can kind of put into a different track. But yeah, there's a lot of irony in the Corps of Engineers being a significant seat at the table as we implement these plans.
So there are serious plans then to divert the rivers back into the wetlands.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we can't do it without it. Sure. And it's certainly something that's not without some controversy. And, you know, some of the fishermen that we work with very closely on the BP response, you know, get very concerned when you talk about river diversions, because you do change the salinity regime in certain areas. But again, without that change, we just are all losers, because we'll not see that marsh sustain itself. It's going to be gone. So, it's a very big undertaking. It's expensive. I mean, the state's plan alone is a $50 billion initiative, but spending that over 50 years. And it's certainly something that, you know, without it, we're going to be, you know, just New Orleans will be kind of a city. It'll be an island there in the Gulf Coast, because it won't have the marsh and the swamp and the barrier islands around it that it really needs to protect itself. So the nation's already committed about $15 billion to helping New Orleans recover its levee system that was supposed to be strong enough to deal with Katrina. What we say is that, look, the marsh restoration that's around that is, it's really, you know, taking care of that investment. And all the sweat equity that all these kind of community groups that have come down to New Orleans helped us recover over the past 7 years in the wake of Hurricane Katrina and Rita. You know, these folks have put a lot of time and energy and resources. We've got to protect that investment by doing the wetlands restoration, which, of course, if you do that, there's all sorts of other ancillary benefits for the rest of the nation, the fisheries, the shipping, all the value to the habitat, which, you know, folks who go duck hunting in Minnesota really need Louisiana's coastal wetlands to help protect the habitats that all these different species rely on.
Well, just in closing, Aaron Vars, a couple of days ago I interviewed a former Deputy Attorney General. We're talking about President Obama's appearance in the Rose Garden with Eric Holder and other officials announcing that they're going to get tough on oil speculation, which is responsible for about 40% of the price of gasoline, the gaming that's going on Wall Street. And the former Deputy Attorney General said to me that perhaps the president was trying to embarrass Holder by literally putting him on camera, because he's been so hopeless at going after. Nobody's gone to jail for what happened in 2008 on Wall Street. Nobody's gone to jail over the ripping off of American consumers and gouging them at the pump by Wall Street predators and parasites, and nobody's gone to jail for the BP oil disaster. So do you think the top cop on America's top cop on the beat is going to step up?
It's an interesting question, and we certainly hope so, because, I mean, we talk about these Clean Water Act fines, that this liability of $5 to as much as $20 billion. You know, the best way to get the most out of that is having a very aggressive Department of Justice showing, you know, that BP spilled as much oil as possible, making the case that BP was grossly negligent and cutting corners, you know, from a cost perspective, cost driving that decision making process, which, you know, in all the analysis I've seen seems pretty obvious. But you do need, you know, really top attorneys making that case, making it hard against against BP, so they come to the table and pay the most fines possible. So we need DOJ to step up here. They made a big show of coming down to New Orleans. We've got a very aggressive U.S. Attorney's Office in New Orleans, and they've done a lot of great work on corruption and a lot of great work in kind of finding the money after Katrina to make sure it wasn't going awry. But, you know, without really got good leadership, I think, you know, taking on BP is something we're going to need Holder to truly get behind. And they did a big press conference talking about how they're going to go after BP with all the, you know, the weight of the federal government. But that's been a while. We have not seen those criminal charges filed, and I think it's really time to amp up the pressure on BP, because gosh knows they're getting lots of good publicity that they're buying, of course, telling their side of the story. It's time for the federal government to tell another side of it.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Aaron Viles.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Ian.
Again, I'm speaking with Aaron Viles, who leads the Gulf Restoration Network's response to the BP oil disaster and the organization's efforts to protect and restore coastal habitats throughout the Gulf. He serves on the executive committee of the Delta Chapter of the Sierra Club, the board of advisors to the Gulf Coast Fund for Community Renewal and Ecological Health, the Marine Fish Conservation Network, and previously worked on Governor Bobby Jindal's environmental transition team. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back as Earth Day approaches. We'll be back talking about what you can do to stop global warming. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gar Lippo, who's an activist and independent journalist whose published works include writings on political economy and climate change for the online magazine Grist. He's the author of the new book, Solving the Climate Crisis Through Social Change, Public Investment in Social Prosperity to Cool a Fevered Planet. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gar Lippo.
I'm glad to be here, Ian.
And obviously, today we're a couple of days ahead of Earth Day on Sunday. I'll be broadcasting live from the Los Angeles Times Book Fair at USC, but obviously Earth Day should not go unnoticed, and I'm glad that you can join us. Your book offers up a lot of solutions that citizens can do in terms of their own carbon footprint, but let's just begin with the political problem itself, and that is that as long as we have the corrupt political system we have in this country, where since Citizens United, there's just a flood of corporate money pouring in. The powerful corporations essentially own our politicians, and the most powerful among them are the oil companies. So as long as we have the political system we have, it seems to me very unlikely that there will be any political change to address the challenge of climate change.
Well, I think you're right, but I think it's a larger problem than you laid out. It's worth remembering that we've had our politicians mostly a wholly owned subsidiary of the corporate system long before Citizens United. That made it much worse. But the fact is, we've had a Supreme Court decision decades ago that said money is free speech, which itself, that's much older than Citizens United. And that causes a lot of problems. And then I think you'll find the politics ultimately comes problem is from the extreme inequality and atomization or fragmentation in our society. That is, it's hard to tackle either the climate crisis or any of the other problems while you've got such huge disparities in economic power. And the political power tends to... the political power tends to flow from that ultimately I think you'll find the climate crisis, and that's one of the points of the book, the climate crisis stems from the same causes as a lot of our other crises. That is, you've got the unemployment, you have inequality between men and women, and they're all stemming from fragmentation and inequality. So fundamentally, the idea of the book is that the political and economic point of the book, which is the main point of the book, is that the climate crisis, like many of our other problems, are actually toxic waste as a side effect of our political and economic system.
So are you suggesting then, Gallipa, that we have to change our political economic system first, or is that
we're at the same time. It's because here's the thing. How do you change a political and economic system? You don't abstractly say, oh, let's get a new system. You fight concrete battles. And so it's not that you do it first, but that fighting to solve the climate crisis has to be seen as part of a larger fight. You fight to solve the climate crisis. You fight for other ecological issues. You fight for justice, economic justice. You know, you fight for single-payer health. You fight for women's rights. You fight for labor rights. That's extremely important. You do all these things. And yes, you fight to get the money out of politics. You do these 101 battles we have to do, but they need to be linked. They need to somehow get some sort of network or way that all these fights stop being so fragmented and tend to converge together. And that's why, for all its many flaws, why the Occupy movement is so important, because it's the first time we've seen something where you do have a lot of different groups coming together.
Again, I'm speaking with Gallipa, who's an activist and independent journalist whose published works include writing on political economy and climate change for the online magazine Grist. He's the author of the new book, Solving the Climate Crisis Through Social Change, Public Investment in Social Prosperity to Cool a Fevered Planet. And we're talking about this in advance of Earth Day on Sunday. Of course, you've got a chapter in your book, if you want to get to heaven, you got to raise a little hell. I guess that's what you're talking about. But this is a profound transition, though, isn't it, from the people have got to take back the power, their own power. They've got to find their own power, in effect. That's a summary of what you're saying, because the powerful, the wealthy, money seems to talk in this country, and the 1% have concentrated wealth, and they seem to be basically calling the tune at the moment. Do you think that the climate change issue will galvanize the powerless into action?
On its own, no. I don't think any environmental cause has ever been strong enough in the U.S. public mind to be a high enough priority to say, we're going to do all this to solve the climate crisis. But fortunately, you don't have to. For instance, one of the big points about in the book is that one of the major solutions is massive public investment. Because a lot of these things, no matter how much you get, you know, you make pollution more expensive, which a lot of mainstream environmentalists say is the big thing you have to do. Well, it's certainly one of the things you have to do to make pollution more expensive. But at the same time, there are a lot of problems out there that aren't going to be solved. You're not going to get trains by making pollution more expensive. And the truth is, because of the way people act, you're not going to get houses well insulated. Right now, if people acted just on the basis of things being expensive enough, most of our houses would be a heck of a lot better insulated. And so ultimately, you need large-scale public investment. You need public taxpayer money going into a lot of these things. Well, the good thing about that is that also provides a heck of a lot of jobs. It helps break our whole economic bottleneck. So one of the things we need to do to solve the climate crisis, massive public investment in green infrastructure, can also be supported as a way of helping the 99% economically. And in fact, a lot of unions and civil rights groups support just this. There's the Blue Green Alliance out there. The NAACP has a huge portion of their organization devoted to fighting climate change, and so on and so forth. So it's not like a lot of civil rights and labors and feminist groups don't already realize this and are already working on these things for that very reason. So that's what gives hope. And there, and of course, public investment is just one of the things, but you'll find the same thing happens. Almost everything we have to do to solve the climate crisis also helps solve other crises. So if environmentalists would stop trying to say we are, you know, the key problem, we're the ones tackling the key problem, rally around us and start saying, hey, we're out here, we're supporting this in solidarity with you, and looking at themselves as one movement among many and pushing their agenda in a way that helps others solve their agenda, that is a huge opportunity.
Well, of course, that's been one of the problems with the political left in this country is the balkanization of identity politics, and that people can't get beyond their own identity and their own particular political, dare I say, obsession. That, of course, requires a rethinking, reorientation of the very nature of political activism, and to actually practice what a lot of people on the left preach, which is solidarity. There isn't a lot of solidarity on the left. That's the whole problem.
You're absolutely right, and that's one of the things that this book pushes, is the importance of solidarity. But it shows how solidarity would benefit everybody, that it's not just a nice political principle, that it's political survival.
So what about personal morality? I mean, I remember when Bush and Cheney got elected, Cheney made the remark about electric cars, that you know, that environmentalism is about personally feeling good, but it doesn't really amount to much. I mean, that is the most cynical attitude that's still fairly pervasive. But beyond recycling and stuff like that, I heard a very interesting suggestion from a climate scientist up in Washington State University who has studied mass extinctions, and most of them, I think 4 out of 5 have been the result of climate change. He said that one simple thing that people can do throughout the entire planet will be to paint their roofs white. Have you heard that suggestion?
I have. It's a sort of mitigation. Especially, would be even better if it was paint the roofs white and paint roads and to paint roads and pavements white as well, parking lots. Mm-hmm. That could be a huge short-term reduction in warming. It doesn't reduce emissions, but it kind of helps counteract some of them, gives us time. You know, is other things you can do. Is, you know, we had a thing where I think we insulated about a few million homes with public investments. I think every home that's under insulated could be insulated with public funds. That would be a really tremendous employment thing. And the book also outlines how you could actually replace our electric grid with mostly solar and wind over the course of 20 years, and how you, just in an appendix, and also how you can then take that, how you can use energy more efficiently, not only in homes, but in transportation and in industry, and how you could gradually use this renewable electricity to replace most of the energy consumption in those sectors as well. And so that's the important thing. And yes, in the meantime, absolutely, anything like this, because the one thing about these white roofs and white pavements and things is it's cheap enough that that a city that's progressive or a state that's progressive could probably fund that. And although it's a little more expensive, you know, cities and states are doing a lot on insulation. Again, not on the scale that needs to be done. No city can afford to insulate every home in the city. That ultimately would take federal funds. But a lot of cities and counties and states fund insulation, at least for poor people and for elderly people, and that's a good start.
So, just in closing, Gallipo, the book talks about the 17th century forests of New England, the evolution of housework over 200 years, the American addiction to the automobile, the lettuce fields of California in the 1970s, the guano wars of the 19th century in Bolivia, Chile, and Peru. Just give us a sense of how those disparate incidents, historical incidents, tie together into your thesis.
To give you one or two examples, The thing about housework, for instance, in housework, one example is that over the course of housework, you gradually got, over the 17th and 18th century, technology eliminated a lot of housework, but a lot of it was housework that had been done by men and by children, and women's workload did not drop much. And then once you got to the early 20th century and you started getting automobiles, one of the things that happened was that stores moved from delivery. It had been pretty common for stores to deliver groceries. You would go to, if you were going to a store as opposed to buying from a door to a peddler, you would go to that store, you would select your stuff, and then you would go home and they would deliver it. And, or in some cases, you would even phone the store and ask them to deliver things. And what they started saying is, we can provide the groceries a lot cheaper if we have self-service. But the reason it was cheaper is that you had the women going to the store in the automobiles and pick it up. And because women's time was counted as nothing, that grocery delivery was counted as a complete saving, no net cost. And so one of the things that happened is, before the elimination of delivery, even though you had suburbs going, they were what was called streetcar suburbs, where they were at, where the suburbs were a lot like small towns. And so people would take a train into the city, and you would have the suburb where you still didn't need, weren't automobile dependent. You still could have get along around with delivery and bicycles and walking. And once you had people driving to the stores, all of a sudden the suburbs didn't have to be built that way, and you got the modern suburb where you have to drive everywhere. And that contributed as much as commuting to our automobile dependence. Now, everyone thinks about, well, people take their cars and drive to work, but that's actually only a tiny percent of automobile emissions. If you look at it, shopping and school and church and recreation account for a lot more automobile emissions than personal transportation to work. And it's and the evolution, the gendered nature of housework, and not counting housework and shopping and things as in any way a cost, helped contribute to that. Now, I don't know how much time you have, but there
I think we pretty much don't have a lot of time to go through the rest of them.
Those other stories are the same thing, where emissions arose as a side effect of other things. You know, what you're seeing when I talk about housework, that's you see that the main point about that is the injustice to women. It's not the emissions aren't the main story there, but the emissions there are a side effect. And the same thing happened in all these other things. Pollution is a toxic side effect of the way inequality and markets tend to work.
Well, clearly there's an awful lot to be learned from your book, and I thank you for joining us here today, Gail Lippow.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Gail Lippow, as an activist and independent journalist whose published works include writing on political economy and climate change for the online magazine Grist. He's the author of the new book, Solving the Climate Crisis Through Social Change, Public Investment in Social Prosperity to Cool a Fevered Planet. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday, Earth Day, from the LA Times Book Fair at USC. Bye for now.